Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Federal Sign v. Texas Southern.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert Lasalle present argument for the petitioner in Federal Sign. He has reserved 8 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. A state like a merchant makes a contract, a dishonest state like a dishonest merchant willfully refuses to discharge it. The latter, the merchant, is amenable in a court of justice. Upon general principles of right shall the former, the state, when summoned to answer the demands of the creditor, be permitted Proteus-like to assume a new appearance and to insult him in justice by declaring, I am a sovereign state. The answer is surely not. Those are the words of Justice Wilson, written 200 years ago in the case of Chisholm versus Jordan. Justice Wilson was one of the framers of the United States Constitution.
And yet,
more to the point, sir.
And yet, you can't sue the United States.
Well, you can in the court of claims to assert a contract.
After you go through the administrative process that we're required to get there.
That's correct.
But the rule that you advocate in this case would not have that protection that the administrative process offers.
For two reasons.
Why not?
First of all, because of the nature of a contract, the state, by the doctrine of implied mutual consent, authorizes itself to be sued when it breaches the contract. That's the provision which has been adopted in about 10 or 12 states across the country. The second reason is that such an administrative preclearance violates the open courts provision of this Constitution. Let me start with the open courts provision first. It is paramount, as set forth in the Constitution, I believe Section 29, that the Bill of Rights is inviolate from judicial, legislative, governmental encroachment. One of those rights is the open court provision. The open court provision, as was dissected in McCoy versus Hanlon by this court, as well as Nelson versus Cruzan and Sachs versus Lutterworth, specifically says that the courts of this state shall be open. It's mandatory. They shall be open to every person, and they shall be open for every claim. And a remedy will be provided by due course of law. There's no exception for state of war. There's no exception for state of emergency. There is no exception when one of the parties on the other side of the lawsuit happens to be the state of Texas. In a contractual setting, the state has obligated itself and bound itself, and it should be no different than any other citizen who has pledged itself to abide by a contract.
Are our repeated holdings that the open court provision only applies to protect well-recognized common law causes of action that have been abrogated by statute, is that just wrong? Do we need to repeal or overrule all those cases?
I'm not aware of any decision that holds that a breach of contract action is not a well-recognized cause of action. The state, Texas Southern University, has argued that since Texas adopted the common law in 1840 as it existed in England and the various states of this country, that sovereign immunity was present. But therefore, my claim as I stand here today, and just as if I had stood there in 1840, would not be cognizable, and I say that's wrong.
Well, if there's a sovereign immunity claim in this case, it is because of a judicially erected defense, whether first erected in England in 1802 or by this
correct.
Court at some point.
That is correct.
And our court has held repeatedly that our expansion or contraction of the common law does not violate open courts. Now, my question is, are you saying that we've just been wrong in that? And some states go the other way under a nearly identical open court language.
Well, I think the answer to that is twofold. Number one, four justices of this court, including yourself, have acknowledged that the doctrine of sovereign immunity is one that can be abrogated by this court. Number one. That's in the Texas Department of Mental Health case versus Petty. There you were dealing with the Tort Claims Act. The principle's the same. Number two, I firmly disagree that a common law breach of contract action was not recognized a common law against the state. So therefore, your decisions under the open courts provision would not restrict your ability to recognize that that open courts provision allows a breach of contract action to be filed against the state. Now, let me take by way of example what the legislature and this court has pronounced with regard to the Tort Claims Act. Under the Sachs case and the rest of them, dealing with open courts provisions, we talked about reasonable restraints on a well-recognized cause of action. The reasonable restraints placed by the legislature were, among other things, capping the amount of damage you could recover against the state for certain specified torts. That has withstood scrutiny under the open courts provision as a reasonable restraint. With good reason, because tort actions are not intentional, barring intentional torts like assault and battery, what have you, but those things are accepted out of the Tort Claims Act anyway. We're dealing with something that's negligent, was not meant to happen.
But why isn't accepting those out a violation of the open courts provision as you look at it?
Because of the due process test the courts have applied in that situation to measure the restraints the state has placed.
We say you can't sue them for intentional acts, but you can't sue them where the discretion is involved. You can't sue them unless it involves an automobile or the use of personal or real property.
Right.
How are those reasons?
Well, the one of the classic cases is the Barr versus Bernhardt case, which is several years old, dealing with immunity of an official or a public school official. If a coach beats up a student, that coach, and it's found to be an intentional tort, that coach is responsible for his own actions. They're not binding upon the state. When the state, acting through its authorized agencies, enters into a contract, the state binds itself here at TSU, and the state has to stand up for its obligations. One of the first things, and it's a part of what existed in 1840, one of the first things that the people of the state of Texas said to the world, and at least Mexico, in 1835 was that the public faith of Texas is pledged for the payment of any debts contracted by her agents. That's the Declaration of the People of Texas, the General Convention Assembly, found on page 469 of Volume 3 of the Constitution. The right to be compensated for a breach of contract by the state, it pre-existed the adoption of the very first Texas Constitution. When the Constitution was adopted in 1836, they directed the legislature to adopt the common law of England and the common law of the other states, such as it was not inconsistent with what the present circumstance and condition of the people of Texas was. And I respectfully suggest that, and implore that, the situation of the people of Texas was that the state has to honor its contracts, and it is not required to have it pre-submitted to it in the form of legislative consent to do so.
Setting aside the constitutional argument, we have written recently and repeatedly that the waiver of sovereign immunity is a matter for the legislature to consider. Why aren't we bound by that in this case?
I think more accurately, Your Honor, that this court has simply abstained from stepping forward and letting defer to the legislature to do so. I think there's a difference between saying this is constitutionally a matter for the legislature versus sitting back and letting the legislature handle it. This court is empowered by the Constitution. I can't get away from the Constitution. This court and the other courts in the state, including the district courts of Harris County, to hear all disputes, not disputes that deal only with claims that don't involve the state. And so by deferring to the legislature, that's judicial abstention.
But we said we're going to, so how do we get around that?
Nothing says you can't do it now.
Change your minds.
You can't. You did that in the case of Price versus Price when you overruled interspousal immunity. You did it in the case of Davis versus Davis where you overruled the law of Mansfield's case and cited six other instances, not to mention the fact that the Constitution doesn't prohibit a woman from holding office of the governor of the state of Texas in the Strickland case. And finding that the doctrine of common law marriage in this state was consistent with what the people of Texas wanted, as opposed to the common law of England, which did not allow it. You can step in now You could have stepped in 20 years ago, or you could step in 20 years from now, but you are empowered to step in and say that we're not going to wait for the legislature to handle this.
Isn't the good reason for abstention that there really does need to be an administrative process surrounding making claims against the government like the United States has, and to not have it in Texas would do as much harm as it does good?
I don't think it would do any harm whatsoever, frankly. To allow the legislature or a legislative body to pre-clear the merits of a legal dispute violates the separation of powers, for one thing. Now, you can allow it to go on by deferring to the legislature to come up with an administrative mechanism, but I believe the better way to handle it is to allow litigants to file suit. They want to go to the legislature and present their grievance on a building that was erected on the University of Texas campus, fine. But what's to prevent the legislature from saying, we're not going to pay that claim, and you can't do anything about it, which frequently happens. If the legislature granted 100% of the time consent to sue in a contractual setting, I would say that would be a reasonable restraint, that type of administrative function. It doesn't happen like that. So to say, as the state does in this case, that, well, limitations had to start running, your claim hadn't been extinguished, we're just not going to let you sue us. That doesn't resolve the controversy, and that closes the courts to the people that say contrary to the Bill of Rights, which is accepted from the legislative and government power.
Is the legislature still going to have to, if assuming we agree with you, would they still have to appropriate the funds to pay your judgment?
In some instances, yes. In many instances, no.
For instance, and if they elected not to, what's the point?
Oh,
if it's ultimately up to them.
Well, there's a case.
Whether you're going to have an effective remedy or not.
There's a case out of Missouri, the DiCarlo case, which spoke to that, but I think that the principle itself stands, and that is courts don't bother to determine whether or not there is a deep pocket at the other end of the rainbow in the form of a defendant who can pay a judgment. The court's function is to adjudicate. If you can't collect, and there's no question and no dispute, I can't go out if I win this thing and go execute on some property of Texas Southern University. I still have to rely on the graces of the legislature to pay that claim, or Texas Southern University to pay that claim out of its own local funds, which the education code allows it to do. Now, whether or not the judgment is collectible is beside the point. Constitutionally, the courts are to adjudicate. And if, when the legislature takes upon itself, as contended by the state, to the power to create debt and appropriate funds, they claim that to abrogate sovereign immunity violates that principle of separation of powers. I say, when you enter into a contract that's authorized, the debt has been created. Whether you've appropriated the funds at that point in time is irrelevant. Many times those funds are already appropriated. When the claim is adjudicated, that doesn't create a debt. That simply adjudicates the debt, enters judgment on the terms of the debt, the agreement between the parties. If the contract's disputed, it's for the courts to settle that dispute. If the legislature acknowledges the debt in some type of administrative preclearance, fine, we don't have to bother the courts. But the courts are here to adjudicate claims. When we get a judgment, it's up to the legislature or the pertinent local authority, whoever that may be, in this case Texas Southern, to appropriate the money, come up with the money to pay the money. But that doesn't interfere with the judicial function of adjudicating.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ken. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Terry Smith will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Kerry Smith. I'm an assistant to the Attorney General of Texas. This court is being asked today to reverse 150 years of Texas jurisprudence and 150 years of its own rulings. If this court and the various courts of Texas are correct when they have held that this is a jurisdictional matter, then this court is being effectively asked to simply expand its own jurisdiction on its own. The case would probably be a lot simpler if we had something straightforward in our Constitution that said one way or the other what the powers of government were
don't we?
No, Your Honor.
If Texas, if a representative of Texas Southern came in and said, I want to buy a new lawnmower for our grounds, and I'm a vendor, and so I give them that lawnmower and send them a bill, and they said, now sue me, couldn't I make an argument that they've taken my property under Section, Article 1, Section 17 of the Constitution? Doesn't the Constitution specifically say that the government cannot take property without paying for it?
Yes, it does, Your Honor. And I think the point I was trying to make is illustrated very well by that very provision. It does not say the government may take. It assumes that the government has that power. All it says is when they do, they have to pay. And that is the impact of Article 1, Section 17, is the limitation on government. It says when they did something that we assume government has the right to do, government has to pay. But it does not expressly say the government can take. That's nowhere contained in there. And in that sense, the powers of our government are assumed and not enumerated and not defined in a very global and general sense. This court has held a number of times that our Constitution is a limiting document. Article 3, Section 1 vests that power, which is called legislative or governmental or plenary by this court, in the legislature. And that is where we submit power to waive the state's immunity from suit would lie.
Well, my question is going to be, doesn't the Constitution specifically say the state does not have the option to choose not to pay?
When it takes private property for public use without the consent of the owner, that is correct. And that very provision was before this court in 1949 in a case that I don't believe is in our brief, but in the last couple of days, getting familiar with this, has come up and will be in a supplement I will file. Texas Highway Department versus Weber, which is at 219 Southwest 2nd 70. The gentleman had his field burned due to the highway department's activities, and he filed a lawsuit claiming that it was a takings under Article 1, Section 17. And in looking in that, the court said two things that I think are significant. This court said, the constitutional provision of Texas under consideration and more or less similar provisions are contained in the constitutions of all the states of this nation, without doubt constitutes a limitation on the right of eminent domain, which power is an inherent attribute of sovereignty. And the court went on to compare that to the state's lack of liability for torts, because this is way before the Tort Claims Act. No respondent superior, no liability for the acts of its agents. And noting one's life and person are infinitely more valuable than his material possessions, had it been intended by the framers of our Constitution that the state should be liable for all tortious acts of its agents, it would have been so stated in the article in question in some form or manner. Instead, the provision relates only to private property which is taken for public use. Manifestly, it was not intended that where private property has been damaged or destroyed through the tortious conduct of the state's agents in the performance of their official functions, the state should be suable. What this court did was look at that limitation on the power of government as applying in eminent domain and inverse condemnation cases and concluded because it does not apply to torts and it does not apply, I would submit, equally well, this court should conclude that because it does not apply to contract cases, that is one of the plenary powers reserved to the legislature.
So you're saying sovereign immunity is constitutionally grounded?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
It's not a common law doctrine.
That is a phrase, I don't have an alternative phrase for it. I would submit that it is not a common law doctrine in the same sense that official immunity for governmental employees is.
So notwithstanding our language that it was is within our power to abrogate sovereign immunity, you disagree with that because you think sovereign immunity is constitutionally grounded and we do not have the power.
That is correct, Your Honor.
What do you do with the language in all the cases where we
call it a common law power, and note that it is within our power to abrogate it, but we nevertheless defer to the legislature on these matters.
Well, I believe there's two issues in that question, Your Honor. And the first one is the labeling of common law power. I don't know that that has much significance because I don't know what label one should put on it when one is identifying an unenumerated power of government that is assumed by our Constitution to exist. Is it a common law doctrine to say that the government has police power and can do certain things, and it can take or destroy your property for public use? The Constitution doesn't say it can do that, but the courts have said it can, and they've used the term police power. I don't know. Is that a common law doctrine? If it is, then it too is subject to abrogation by the court, just as many other powers of government that are not enumerated but are merely limited by our Constitution would be. If the courts were correct for the last 100 years in calling this a jurisdictional matter, I would submit that jurisdiction does not flow from the common law. It flows from the Constitution and the statute, and it is really an Article II issue. It's for the legislature to abrogate. And that is ultimately why this court has said it is a matter for the legislature. And now I'm obviously dealing with the second issue. If, in fact, it is appropriate for the court to abrogate jurisdiction under its common law authorities. We are submitting that it is not appropriate for the court to do that because we believe the language of Article 3, Section 1, and this court's prior interpretations of that, and I'll submit the cases for these. It is well established the state legislature is clothed with all governmental power which resides in the people, subject to such limitations as may be expressed in the Constitution of the state and any limitation embraced in the Constitution of the United States. There can be no dispute that in this state the provisions of the Constitution serve only as a limitation on the power of the legislature and not as a grant of power. The power and authority of the state legislature is plenary, and its extent is limited only by the express or implied restrictions therein contained in or necessarily arising from the Constitution itself. And I would also add that the legislature has relied on this court's opinion that this is a jurisdictional matter for the legislature for at least 60 years. Our brief refers to Chapter 107 in the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, which sets out the mechanisms for obtaining a resolution from the legislature granting consent to sue. Prior to that, Article 4351.5 was in place, and it said the same thing with much less detail, that a resolution is the proper way to get consent.
If the federal sign had delivered this sign and Texas Southern was in fact using it, and if Texas Southern said, we're not going to pay you one red cent from this point forward, there would be no remedy absent a legislative consent to sue. Is that your position?
Absent legislative consent, that is correct, Your Honor.
If, in fact, they have a security interest, perfected security interest, can they come in and repossess it? Or are they devoid of all remedies whatsoever?
Well, you're getting way beyond my expertise with that question, Your Honor. I frankly don't know what the limitations on the law.
But as far as you're concerned, there is no remedy whatsoever
if the remedy they seek is damages, money, this court's opinions have consistently held that is a suit within the scope of the doctrine of immunity and any consent from the legislature.
Ordinarily, when you and I would enter into a contract, I would say I will purchase this item from you in return for your promise to pay me, and the enforceability is based upon the mutuality of agreements. Is that not the case in a contract with the state? Is there no mutuality?
The case law has never suggested that the state is not liable in contract like anyone else. What it has done is bifurcate liability from immunity from suit and say, in contracts, we are liable. And indeed, there wouldn't be a contract if we weren't.
But that's pretty hollow, isn't it?
we're liable, but we're never going to pay you.
Your Honor, I don't believe...
We don't have to, we're the state.
With all due respect, I do not believe one can legally reach the conclusion that anyone is never going to be able to get consent.
Well, but you can't do it without their consent. I mean, if I were dealing with John Doe in a contract and he said, well, if I don't perform, you can, I'll be liable, of course, but you can't sue me and you can't collect unless I agree to it. I'd be kind of reluctant to get into a deal like that.
But parties know about sovereign immunity. They're certainly charged with knowledge of that, and they know that if they believe the state has breached, their remedy is to go to the legislature and seek consent. And
what?
If the legislature...
If we were writing on a clean slate today, what would be the political science, philosophical justification for that? What would be the good reasons for having that be the rule?
The original justifications in the older opinions are the fiscal justifications of allowing the state to control the expenditure of revenues and to anticipate what those would be.
And that has some weight in the tort context because the damages are more uncertain in the tort context. But in a contractual context, the damages are not so uncertain.
Well, certainly in construction contract context, the damages are often extra work and quantum merit that are way beyond the scope of the original contract and equally uncertain in that regard. They're often millions of dollars, certainly far in excess of the limitations of the Tort Claims Act. One of the other justifications for why it should be to the legislature goes to the court's presumption that the legislature will grant consent where there is merit and will weed out some of the meritorious claims. Now, there's more to that story. I think it needs to be pointed out that the legislature has the authority to pay a claim. It's not necessary to sue the state and reduce one's claim to judgment before the legislature can appropriate a claim.
In fact, as we've seen recently, the lieutenant governor apparently has the power to pay a claim. Right?
Even after
it failed the legislature, there still appears to be some discretionary way that claims can be paid.
That does appear to be what happened in that case.
That's all a matter of grace, is it not? Not of right?
Collection?
Yeah. Payment of any
payment.
Claim is all a matter of legislative grace, and there is no right, you say, to compel payment.
That's what this court has consistently held, Your Honor, yes. That's way beyond the scope of Article 1, Section 17, as this court has interpreted it. And I believe the observations made earlier about the open courts provision are indeed accurate. In fact, if a doctrine that has only been articulated judicially, then that's sovereign immunity. And again, I don't know if we should call it common law or call it something else, but that's where we find out what it is and what the scope of it is. It's in the judicial opinions. And if that violates the open courts provision, then every other doctrine that comes from judicial opinions is subject to that challenge as well, obviously. Whenever the court says there is no cause of action for this recognized in Texas, the same challenge would apply under open courts. If open courts is going to be used to apply to doctrines that are only articulated in judicial opinions.
Mr. Smith, let me ask you a question that's somewhat tangential. As Justice Heck has observed in the Green case, State Budget Board through whatever political compromises were made with the Lieutenant Governor, that claim was paid. The identical issue as to whether or not the state has consented to be sued in a contract was in the Green International versus State case, and that case was settled. I'm assuming the state paid some money on that case too. If the state has paid Mr. Green, Green International, and Green in the other, in the whistleblower case, why isn't the state paying this claim? Because apparently the federal sign is not political muscle to talk the Lieutenant Governor to do what they did in the whistleblower case for this case.
Well, Your Honor, I
help me understand what sorted out.
I think one has to approach, again, from the perspective that there's more than one party involved in any set of litigation. A case such as Green International cannot be settled until both sides agree on a figure. And if the non-state party to a dispute insists on more money than the state's willing to pay...
Well, we have a jury finding. We have a jury finding here.
Well, not in Green International. In this case, in fact, there is one, but it's our position that that was basically tried in a court that did not have jurisdiction over that matter.
Can the AG settle this case?
Well, again, I would have to go back to the newspaper on George Green's case on that. The current Appropriations Act, like the last one, had language in there that says no money can be used to pay a settlement or a judgment of a case except in the terms of this act. And there is global language this time that was not in the other act. Up to $250,000 out of an agency's budget can be used where there is a valid waiver of sovereign immunity. And under certainly the current case law, we don't believe there is one in this case.
Do you agree
before we get to just make sure you did pay some money on Green International.
Yes, sir.
Under identical
and,
situation.
And the way that occurred was that the resolution was granted, but the case was not filed. The other case that was filed prior to getting consent, Green International had basically lost, although it was writ granted here. The agency still had its initial authority to conclude, hey, we owe you guys more money, here's what we'll offer you. And Green International agreed with the agency on what an appropriate figure would be. So under its contracting authority and the lack of litigation, it did not run into the problems in the Appropriations Act that I cited. And all I can really say is that gets extremely complex, and I think probably someone from the bowels of the controller's office would be more appropriate for explaining why that can work sometimes and not work other times.
Does the dean have a question?
I was having a little bit of difficulty in what you're talking about. Do you accept the premise that even if Federal Sign had a judgment, it would have to wait on an appropriation from the legislature to pay?
One way or another, yes.
So if that's the case, isn't that sufficient to meet the state's concern about the opportunity to deal with its finances and not have a rate on the Treasury and all those circumstances? Isn't the fact the state can control the payment on the judgment as opposed to the suit to begin with, does that satisfy all the state's concerns about the rate on the Treasury?
Well, Your Honor, we're almost shifting it from a legal analysis to a political analysis. And that is inherent in this if it is a legislative power. Obviously.
Well, you can see that the state has an obligation to pay if they take property for public use. And you're not arguing in this case. I mean, there doesn't seem to be an argument in this case. This was the state was contracting for something for public use, right? So you have no problem with the state being obligated to pay for that.
If the state has liability and has breached a contract, we are not saying the state isn't liable or shouldn't have to pay. All we are saying is it's up to the legislature to grant consent to the suit. And when that is granted, then that can be appropriately resolved in court. We are also observing that the legislature has the power to pay a claim without it being resolved in court. Federal Sign can go to the legislature at the next session and seek consent or payment. And either one can happen. Or it can be denied, in which case they can go back to the next session. One of the parties that got consent in this session appeared in 1989, 1991, 1993, and got it in 1995. And they certainly could have gone to court
immediately after the 1989 session and said, it's impossible, I can't get consent, they turned me down. You should abrogate this doctrine and allow me to proceed. But in fact, legally, it's not possible to conclude they can't get consent. They came back, they did get consent. The same would apply to federal science.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
I respectfully assert that if we had presented this claim to the legislature before filing suit, we would have been one of the parties weeded out.
Well,
because
if the legislature is not going to pay your claim, wouldn't it be better to know that ahead of time rather than after you spend a whole bunch of money trying to lawsuit?
There's a certain school of thought to that.
Yeah.
But the claim has been adjudicated, and we had our day in court under the open court provision and under common law. We filed a lawsuit. We adjudicated it, and we won. The state denied authority to enter the contract. The jury found it wasn't. The jury found the contract. They found it breached. They found damage.
But surely, a practical person would want to know, if there's no way I'm going to get paid except by the grace of the legislature, why do I want to pay my lawyer and take my time and run up the state's expense to have a trial that's not going to result in me?
The answer to that lies in something counsel said, and that is anybody who deals with the state ought to know better. And my answer to that is, and it also refers to the fact that maybe we aren't writing a clean slate here. 100 years ago, there was a case of Christo versus Blunt, which makes no reference, no holding, that you have to get the consent of the legislature to file a breach of contract suit. What it says is, the state's to be regarded as a sovereign when it's performing governmental functions, has prerogatives which don't appertain to the individual. But when it becomes a suitor in its own court or a party to a contract with a citizen, the same law applies to it as under like conditions governs the contracts of an individual. There is reference in the Christo case to a New York case wherein it says New York law requires legislative consent. The Christo court does not say we agree with that and that's the law in Texas. As a matter of fact, the case that is universally cited in the state is the proposition of the date and point in time when this court adopted the doctrine of sovereign immunity is Hosner versus DeYoung, which is the first volume of the Texas report. Hosner versus DeYoung was a mandamus case. That's the one everybody says you got to get consent of the legislature. Christo versus Blum makes absolutely no reference to that case, none whatsoever. None. The second case that is universally cited and was also cited by the Court of Appeals in this case is W.D. Hayden versus Dodger. That is cited for the proposition, if you're going to sue the state, keep in mind that it's liable in contract, but you got to give its consent to sue it. Hayden versus Dodgen was not a contract case. It was a permit case. The plaintiff in that case was given a permit. And the Supreme Court Justice Calvert specifically noted that the state had its option when it entered into its arrangements with this guy. To give him a permit or to give him a contract mutually binding on the parties. The prior option was chosen, that of a permit. A permit is not a contract. It's not an agreement to be mutually bound. Reference to W.D. Hayden versus Dodgen in the contract setting is inappropriate. So I respectfully suggest that we are not writing a clean slate here. The last pronouncement in a contractual setting by this court was in Christo versus Blum. The last time the issue was raised was in Delaney versus University of Houston and Justice Doggett dissented, I believe, in that decision, but it had to do with a tort. The claim was made that the official handbook of the university was a contract. I said, well, that's just nonsense because it's not a contract, it's a handbook. This is a tort claim. That's the last time this court has been called upon to decide this issue, and I respectfully submit that it was decided in Christo versus Blum 100 years ago.
That was immunity from liability, not immunity from suit.
They made no distinction. No immunity.
But the court has.
The court has.
We have, perhaps erroneously, but we've made that dichotomy.
But not in a contractual setting, Your Honor. You've said that in tort and you've said that in permits, but you've not said that in a contract case, and I respectfully suggest that a contract case is much different than a tort and is much different than a permit. A permit is issued pursuant to a governmental function, like a driver's license. You can drive a car in a state, but you can't do it legally without a license. If you get a license, you've got to go get a permit. Not a driver's license is not a contract. If you revoke somebody's license, you're doing it, but not pursuant to a contractual right, you're revoking it. That is a governmental function. I'd also like to point out that counsel, I believe, for the reason stated before, is mistaken when he said that sovereign immunity and consent to the legislature to sue is constitutional here. That is just not right. Section 29 says, to guard against the transgressions of high powers herein delegated, we declare everything in the Bill of Rights, including the open courts provision, is accepted out of the general powers of government. Anything contrary shall be void. I'm not trying to set up a constitutional cause of action here. I'm simply trying to say that I've got a written contract cause of action. And the state is bound, and it's bound without me having to give legislative consent to sue. We would have preferred not to have to sue, but we had to, and we got it adjudicated, and the jury spoke, and we got a judgment. Now, whether or not we can collect it, okay, that happens all the time. Plaintiffs sue defendants that can't pay, they don't have insurance, and they're stuck with a judgment they have to renew every 10 years. I can't even do that in this case because I can't execute against the state. But the fact remains, they disputed my claim, I would have been weeded out, and I got a judgment. Now it's adjudicated. Herring versus Houston National Bank, which is about the turn of the century, in another case that is universally cited. They weren't dealing with the contract. They were dealing with whether or not a claim was one made against the state or against individuals. No individuals involved in this case. We're solely talking about Texas Southern University, which is an agency of the state. Texas, perhaps, permission of the state, from the state, to sue it was necessary. It never existed in the state 150 years ago. There was a recent article that came out quoting that Texas, if standing alone, would be the 11th largest economy in the world. We are no longer an agrarian society. We are commercially sophisticated, and we deal in very sophisticated issues. We deal with very sophisticated contracting parties who rely on the state of Texas to honor what they say they're going to do. I think it's time that we take the step, that the court takes the step, that it's recognized that it can abrogate sovereign immunity and do so in a contractual setting. If a litigant has no right to enter into a court in this state but for the benevolence of the legislature, then you don't have open courts, and you're giving the legislature, allowing the legislature to encroach on the separation of powers to adjudicate and weed out claims, which is the province of the court to do, not the legislature.
So when the legislature gave specific authority in the education code for the boards of the University of Texas at Tyler and University of Houston to be sued, that was wholly unnecessary?
I think it's appropriate they did it. I think they should do it statewide.
Unnecessary.
I believe it was unnecessary, but I think it's unnecessary only because people have been relying on the idea that legislative consent is necessary. The legislature is writing its own laws, and it deals with those universities or school districts for that matter. They're putting those things in there. It's not necessary. But until the court steps up and says we're going to abdicate sovereign immunity as a law and quit letting the legislature be the gatekeeper, then only then do we realize that sovereign immunity has no place here. I'm sure it's unnecessary they did that. I think from an academic standpoint.
Are you still answering the question? Or?
I'm trying to finish it. From an academic standpoint, I think it was unnecessary. Practically speaking, the legislature caused it.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the oral arguments for today. The foregoing arguments are submitted on briefs and arguments, and the marshal will please adjourn the court.
The audience will please rise. Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas.